beloved congregation of our Lord Jesus Christ. Kids, I have a question for you. Do you hold your parents to their promises? When your parents promise you something good, maybe when you behave, I'm pretty sure you hold them to their promises, saying, well, I did this, now you have to do what you promised. Whatever the promise may be, you've probably looked forward to it, waited for it, maybe even done something for it, and you like to get what is promised to you. Promises are interesting in that way, and also very important. Because I'm imagining that you're thinking of a time, maybe even when promises made you do something difficult. Maybe sitting still is difficult. But when your parents promise you that after church you can do something fun, it may still be tough, but it is a little bit easier. And we all have this. We may be stressed, we may be tired, we don't want to finish our work, but the promise of a relaxed weekend motivates us to just get the job done. Good promises motivate us. They drive us to do whatever needs to be done so that we may get what is promised. And the Bible is full of promises. Whether it's way back where God made promises to individual believers like Abraham, or when he makes promises to his people like Israel or to us, they're always there. They're always at the heart of God's relationship with us. We hear it every time there's a baptism and we read the form and it says, well, a covenant always has two parts, a promise and an obligation. And just as promises in everyday life may motivate us, may drive us, God's promises end up keeping us anchored and persevering. Because they remind us of what is ours today and what will be ours also in the future. And in our text this morning, the promises of God are just drawn again out to be given some attention so that we may all understand the riches we have as new covenant believers. And so that we too may have faith and perseverance. And so our theme this morning is Christ's new covenant promises for you. As mentioned, chapter 8 starts really with, again, a summary of all that has gone before to really get maybe even our attention, saying, okay, this is what it's really about. We've looked at Melchizedek, we've looked at the high priesthood, but this is really what it is about. The key takeaway, the point of what we have been saying is this: we do have such a high priest who sat down at the right hand on the throne of the majesty in heaven and who serves in the sanctuary, the true tabernacle set up by the Lord, not by man. Now, after all that discussion on Melchizedek and the other order of priesthood, we had this picture of what kind of a priest we needed. You know, one who is sinless, blameless, who would serve in heaven, not here on earth. And that wasn't just hypothetical. Hebrews reassures us saying, we have such a high priest in Jesus Christ, who serves not on earth, but at the right hand of God in a heavenly sanctuary. But of course, there are still some unanswered questions. What is Jesus' priesthood really about? Where does he serve? He's going to flesh that out a little bit more. What kind of covenant and covenant promises does he mediate and guarantee? What kind of sacrifice or gift does this priest offer? And that's where the discussion continues in chapter 8 and chapter 9. And in chapter 8, the big topic is this new covenant. Covenant is just that formal relationship that God makes with us, his people. It's often summarized, as it is also in Jeremiah and therefore also in Hebrews, as I will be your God and you will be my people. He will be our God, and all of the promises that come with it of protection and presence, and we will be his people. Faith, perseverance, and service. Now, it may be a while, but we have talked about who the audience of the letter to the Hebrews really is, and it's most likely Jews or Jewish Christians, most likely also those who are persecuted in some way, who are tempted to go back to Judaism, to back to the Old Testament, worshiping in the temple, and all of that. Let's try maybe to imagine some of the struggles that they were facing, because I think we can actually relate to them quite well. So you are a New Testament believer, you come from a Jewish background, now your family, friends are maybe telling you, no, come back to Judaism, Christianity, it's not worth anything, look, you're being persecuted and you're suffering in different ways, just come back. And try to think of them trying to defend what they're doing and why they are Christian. Think about it in this way, this question. How easy or how difficult is it to introduce something new in the church? How easy is it to introduce something new in the church? We could just think, because we sing new songs every Sunday, of that as an example. Never mind start talking about a new covenant. It doesn't matter when you live. When it comes to new things, for some people, new might automatically mean better. Especially in our society today, that's usually what we think and say. If someone says, you know, I have a new phone, they probably mean it is better. I have a better phone now. Especially because with electronics, what is old is very quickly out of date. It's obsolete, to use the language also of Hebrews. New may just sound better because of its newness. And yet, at the same time, we don't always like change. We like what we're used to. We like what is comfortable and familiar. And we might even have very good reason for that. And when Hebrews actually was written, around that time at least, you could probably imagine that most of society would have had some kind of suspicion of anything that's new. Just for example, the reason the Romans would allow Jews to be Jews and not oppress them too much with their state religion and with other kinds of rules was because they said, look, the Jewish religion, it is old, it is revered, we can't touch that because of its antiquity, really, its age. And then Christianity starts to spring up, and at first they're like, okay, it's just like the Jews, it's just another sect. And then they start realizing, like, no, the Jews and Christians don't get along. This is something new. That's suspicious. And we need to deal with it. Now, Hebrews has been and is going to introduce Jesus Christ as a high priest of a new covenant. How do you introduce that? How do you make that palatable for people? How do you counter the hypothetical response, well, if the old covenant was good enough for Moses and David, it's good enough for me? The author is going to have to show us why this new covenant is so much better. And to do this, Hebrews compares, as it has been doing all along. And the first comparison in our text is between that earthly tabernacle temple and a heavenly tabernacle. And the author makes the point that Jesus serves in the true heavenly tabernacle. Now, generally when we hear true, we think the opposite is false. Not really the case here. Rather, think of it as like true versus copy. Like, you might have important documents, or companies may make a prototype of something that they're working on, and they have the original, the first prototype, and then they make copies of it, or copies of documents. The one you keep safe as a guarantee, it's the original, but the others you send out because they're copies. So when the Israelites built the tabernacle in the desert, they were building a copy of God's dwelling place in heaven. That's why the text says, that's why Moses was told, like, follow all of these instructions, make it exactly as you see them. It's supposed to be a copy of God on God's heavenly dwelling place. And really, that's a wonderful, beautiful thought, because you just think of what the tabernacle meant. It meant that God could come down and live among his people. Not only that, you could pack up the tabernacle. He could go with his people wherever they went. He could be in their midst. And these priests, they could sacrifice and minister in this holy, yet heavenly place. And that's what made the Old Covenant and the Levitical priesthood so special and so good. But Hebrews says it was still just a copy and a shadow. It's like having a picture, or, you know, nowadays you can't travel, so you get a virtual tour to some holiday destination, a tourist destination. Like, sure, you could appreciate, like, that's a beautiful picture, or that's a great tour, but it's not like being there in person. So, as amazing as an earthly temple or tabernacle may be, there is something far better in heaven. And by making the point that Jesus serves in the true heavenly tabernacle, think about this. Suddenly, this new priesthood is actually not that new anymore. It's actually very, very old. It's the original. Older than anything that is a copy here on earth. Because this copy, this shadow that was here on earth, wasn't just looking forward to the future when Christ would come, it was actually already looking up to God's dwelling place, which will come down, and we maybe know the promises of Revelation that the new heavenly Jerusalem will once come down to be on earth, to be God in our midst. Now, more as an aside, first now, let's just think about this a little bit, what that means for us even this morning. This is actually one of these texts that help us understand why we don't need a tabernacle or temple anymore. We can worship here in a parking lot. And we can still have access to God's presence as it was even meant to be, because Jesus opened the way for us through his Spirit to worship him in heaven, where he serves at the right hand of his Father. Now, of course, this morning, don't imagine that many of us are struggling with the same questions that these Jewish Christians might have had. Don't think you're necessarily struggling with the fact that the new covenant is new and you're wondering whether it's better than the old covenant or not. But if we consider maybe the underlying questions and struggles that the Jews then had, maybe it hits closer to home. Because as much as it's about a comparison, it's also about the fact that maybe we want to choose and decide for ourselves, to have the freedom to decide, how are we going to relate to God? If you're a Jewish Christian, you think there's maybe two options, Old Covenant, New Covenant, and I'll choose whatever is easier, more comfortable, more familiar. That may not be the way that we do that today, but it may be something else, that we maybe find it easier to relegate, you know, demote Christ to just being a crutch or a friend who's there when we have difficulties, and that'll be the extent of our worship. Instead of realizing who Christ is as the one who claims all of our life and all of our devotion. Or we may make our own little mix of our worship and tabernacle in a way, as if we're just thinking that, well, I know the Bible a little bit. If I just do X, Y, and Z, then that's my worship. That's how I can relate to God, no matter what Scripture says. And Hebrews warns us and reminds us, saying, if you don't have Jesus Christ as your high priest, there is no relationship with God. And it's not just because you then are just worshiping in your own way. No, what you're actually doing is you're missing out on eternal, true, heavenly realities. No matter how easy it may be or how comfortable your alternative may be. And he warns us and reminds us of what we really have in Jesus Christ. But the main argument found in this chapter is that Jesus Christ establishes this new covenant. It's a new covenant that Jeremiah prophesied about years and years before. He prophesied this when the New Testament itself was, you know, looking forward to the New Testament. And all of Israel was really looking forward to something new. I mean, as I mentioned, Jeremiah prophesied during the exile. And just think about during that time how many of the promises of God seemed to have been fulfilled, but then nothing. Because Israel had sinned. I mean, they had the land, the promised land. But now they were in exile. They had these great, glorious kings and David and Solomon and a kingdom. But now they were conquered by their enemies. They had God's presence, that heavenly reality on earth, even if it was a copy in the temple in Jerusalem, but that was all destroyed. It's all because they had broken the covenant. They had been unfaithful. And God had warned them that if they continued to be unfaithful to him, he would punish them for their sins. And Israel was now reaping what they had sown. And their only hope was that God would do something new, that he would be merciful to them, that he would save them, pick them up, you know, plant them, build them up, renew his covenant, promising that he would be their God once again, and that they would be his precious people. And that is the wonderful message that Jeremiah then has for the Israelites. God would again establish his covenant, a new covenant, established on better promises. Now, this is, in some ways, a more difficult biblical theme and topic. How does the old and the new covenant relate? It's not a simple matter as if, you know, the old covenant, that was bad, new covenant, that's good. If you want to do anything like that, you probably should just say the old covenant was good. The new covenant is just that much better. Shadows, copies versus the reality. Heavenly, eternal, true realities. For example, you see that there is still much that the two have in common because the theme, the content is always the same. I will be your God. You will be my people. It's what you find in Hebrews 8 again as well. I will provide and protect, and you will trust and follow and obey me. It stays unchanged, Old Testament, New Testament, Old Covenant, New Covenant. But when we look at the new covenant, as God promises, we see that God promises to do what the old covenant was just longing for, was just hoping for. And three promises stand out in what Jeremiah had to prophesy and in what then Hebrews quotes. Promise number one, I will put my laws in their minds and write them on their hearts. God's law is internalized. And certainly you read Psalms like Psalm 119, as we did and as we sang over more than a year, or Psalm 19, which says, you know, God's law is sweeter than honey. It revives the soul. And you get a sense that, you know, whoever wrote these, the law of God was written on their hearts. Because they're just so full of it. And they see its goodness and it gives their life. And yet still at the same time, from their perspective, and also like as we read from Psalm 119, they're still looking forward to something, for some amazing work of God that he would just save us because we are a sheep who go astray. They're still waiting for God to do something amazing for his people. Because to have God's law on our hearts is a wonderful thing, but it's not natural and it is oh so difficult. Because that's the other thing that we see in the Old Testament. And one thing that we probably all know from our own lives. Just knowing or just hearing God's law doesn't make us do it. Or we may even get that far that we actually do it, but it doesn't come from the heart. You know, we go to church, but we'd much rather be somewhere else. Keeping God's law, the letter at least, but our hearts, it struggles with it. When God's law is not in our hearts, it is that difficult burden that that keeps us really perhaps even feeling as if we can't enjoy life because it's always there. And that's also what Israel learned under the Old Testament. Just having the law as Moses, as the Lord gave to Moses and he to them, wasn't going to transform them and make that beautiful paradise here on earth. It didn't have the power to change a sinful heart. You can tell yourself over and over again, I just need to do better. I just need to do better. I just need to do better. But that isn't going to change who you are. And that's where when Christ appears and when we get that gospel news that, you know what the law was unable to do because of our sinful nature, Christ has done. By becoming man, fulfilling the law, and pouring out his spirit that may write that law on our hearts. The point being that you need Christ, and that you need grace and the gospel. You need a new covenant where the Spirit sent, where God sends his spirit to transform your heart because of his amazing grace. Grace that may even take that burden that is the law and that you struggle with so much, that maybe crush your soul and make it to that which revives your soul and gives you life. It's the wonderful will of God written on your heart. Promise number two, no longer will a man teach his neighbor or a man, his brother, saying, know the Lord, because they will all know me from the least of them to the greatest. This is the verse that warns ministers that then one day they too will be obsolete, perhaps, out of a job. It's the kind of thing that would have been unthinkable in the Old Testament. If you wanted to approach God, if you wanted to know God's will for your life, you or someone asked you about it, you'd probably say, well, go ask a prophet. Go ask for a priest. Wherever you went, there was always some kind of middleman, some kind of mediator. Access was restricted in different ways, but it was pretty clear to you that access was restricted. There wasn't an openness or a directness to God, at least as much in the setup, or the way that also the religion was set up, or the Old Testament was set up. In fact, to have that access might have been even a dangerous thought. You can't just go to a holy God. But the New Covenant says you all have access to God. Free, bold, direct, immediate access. There is no different, no matter how old or how young you are, whatever your position may be in the church. There's no hierarchy of access. No need for prophets in that sense. Because we all have Jesus Christ as our one high priest. We all come to God only through him, and we're all on equal footing doing so. And it is that one day, you know, we will get to know the Lord far more than now. Now we still need one another, neighbors, brothers, those who help us to know the Lord. So today, yes, on Tuesday, you'll still need to go to catechism. If you're one of the catechism students thinking that, well, the new covenant means I don't have to do that anymore, probably should. Get to know the Lord. But, know this. Know that when it comes to knowing the Lord, you don't just have to take ministers' my word for it, or your parents' word for it, or a teacher's word for it. You may know the Lord firsthand through Jesus Christ. Know him as your God. No middleman for that. Access in prayer, in Bible reading, in living your life before his face, just as we all do. And how is this all possible? What really makes this new covenant so great? I mean, sure, to be able to know God and to have the laws written on their mind, that fixes a lot of the problems and the struggles that Israel had before they went into exile. But really, what needs to be dealt with is sin. And that's promise number three. For I will forgive their wickedness and remember their sins no more. In the Old Testament, year after year, there was always this reminder of sin. The priests offered sacrifices once a year, the great day of atonement. They did so with as a whole feast. There was no end to sin and no end to sacrifice, which also meant no end to you being reminded of your sin. It all went on and on with no end in sight. And yes, look, Adam's sin sent him out into exile from the garden. Israel's sin sends him out of the promised land. Sin is that great destroyer of the relationship, our relationship with God. There's no escaping it. But God says, I will this time promise to deal with it completely, forgive it completely, break that cycle, wash you clean. That one day sin may be completely done away with. It will be sin no more, all wickedness wiped out, a definite end through a high priest. And you might have noticed this in Hebrews, a high priest who sits down because he offered one sacrifice, he underwent judgment, and that is it. It has been dealt with. One perfect sacrifice. So that our sins may be condemned at the cross and forgiven to be remembered no more. So that there would be no threat to God's covenant with us. Let the words that nothing, absolute nothing, can separate us from God's love may be true and fulfilled. Maybe surprisingly, after that very long quotation, the author of Hebrews doesn't even unpack it very much. Just simply draws out that, look, the Old Testament talked about a new covenant, and what is new means that what is old is going to be obsolete, passing away. But his attention to those better promises reminds us that Hebrews is always concerned, has in the back of its mind, God's promises for us. Because it's what gives us certainty and anchors for our faith. It's what gives us a reason and a motivation to hold on and to persevere and to not drift away from our faith. To use other analogies, it's what makes us run with perseverance because you see the prize ahead and you avoid sin and look to Christ. And we need that because every day in different ways, the world is also going to promise us something. Happiness, pleasure, wealth, power, just life in general, whatever it may be. And what you need to fight those temptations for one is better promises. Which means that we can weigh these promises this morning. Consider what God has promised each one of you and what that's worth. Believe that they really are for you. Today, already, you have some wonderful experience of that, but it's going to be even greater in the day to come when Christ returns, and that new covenant and that new covenant meal will be celebrated with Christ in glory. And so let God's promises be your guide and your joy to lighten your load, steady your course, and give you that heart to live for God. Amen. Once everyone gets in their spot, we'll then sing in response hymn 78, stanzas 1, 2, and 3. So hymn 78, 1, 2, and 3.